Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, and welcome to Everything is Fine, a podcast for women over 40. We are your hosts. I'm Kim France.
And I'm Jen Romolini.
And Jen, how is your day?
My day is good. My day is good. I've been getting up at 5 a.m.
Oh my God.
To like make my day happen.
Because you got
to
be awake for the coast.
Got to be awake for the coast and like for the kid and like all the things that my life is. I don't know. It's fine. Everything's fine. Everything's fine. I have a couple of recommendations already in my life that I want to recommend this week before we get into this truly excellent episode with Alessandra O'Dare. Oh, I love this guest. If anyone has not read and picked up Don't Call Me Home, Alex O'Dare's memoir of growing up in the Chelsea Hotel with her mother, Viva, superstar, who was a Warhol person. You should pick it up. The book is excellent. I've been talking about it for months, and I can't believe we got to talk to her. She was awesome.
She was great.
So this weekend, in my new editor, beauty editor life already, I was invited to try a new treatment. And I have to say, I think it's a good one. So, you know, Morpheus 8, the microneedling,
yes.
You know, and it uses radio frequency, but it also really, really hurts. And it also leaves you kind of banged up and bruised. Mm-hmm. Well, there's another one that's called Vivace. Can't be that. It's Vivace. V-I-V-A-C-E. They all pronounced it like really fancy. It's a microneedling procedure that does the same thing that Morpheus 8 does, but with a different kind of needle that's a lot more delicate. And it did not hurt really at all. It felt as hurt maybe as a tattoo, not even. And I got it 3 days ago and my skin looks good. And is not bloody or bruised or puncture wounded or anything. And it's supposed to, build collagen, stimulate collagen and do all the other things, fine lines, the whole thing that Morpheus 8 does. But it's not as painful and doesn't leave you looking like you've been stapled.
No, you look great.
Yeah. So that's my big rec for the week, microneedling.
Microneedling.
How about you?
I started watching the Supermodel series.
Oh, I started watching this too. What did you think?
I mean, I like watching it. It's such a trip down memory lane.
Yeah.
You know, I have, my personal feelings about which of the supermodels I like and which I think are kind of awful. But it is interesting and it makes me have a lot more empathy for all of them, actually, because I've always known it's a really even to be at the top of that field is to be at the top of a really toxic field.
Yeah, I agree.
And I remember Isaac Mizrahi once saying that Cindy Crawford was the only model he knew who wasn't a victim.
Wow. Wow. That's saying a lot. She comes across really well in it. Like, I remember not really liking her very much, like, of the supermodels. Like, she was not my favorite at all. And I think she comes across really well in this. You can really see what she was you know, how she sort of had agency and presence even as a young person. You could see how each of them came to a different. So it's about the four women that were on the cover of Vogue: Linda Evangelista, Naomi Campbell, Christy Turlington, and Cindy Crawford. And you can really see how each of them came to it modeling very differently.
Yeah.
And I think that sort of bore out their experience as, you know, as victims or not, honestly.
I would agree with that, because some of them just stumbled upon it and some of them wanted it badly.
Yes. Yes. Linda Evangelista really wanted it.
Yeah.
I think she might have suffered the worst.
I think she has suffered the worst.
Well, Naomi Campbell, let's not say Naomi Campbell suffered the racism of the industry on top of every other thing. So,
that's true. At a time when they really did think like, oh, we already have a black model.
Yeah. And she was 100% right when she was like February, the only month they put a black model on the cover. Like, I remember that.
We all remember that.
Yeah. I think it's really good. How many episodes are you in?
Just the one.
Okay.
Just the one. But I'm so happy because there's so little to watch right now, I feel like.
There is. I saw a really great movie called Past Lives. And it has the woman from it's Greta Lee, and she was the woman who was in Russian Doll. She was
Yeah, I know who she is. She's so funny.
She's so funny and she's so stylish. But anyway, she's so good in this movie. And this movie is like this beautiful love story. And I don't want to give anything away, but I will say her husband in this movie, the way he's written, is the best man I've ever seen written in a movie, period. With an emotional, with like a rich inner life, not responding in any sort of toxic masculine way. It's the best depiction of a man I've ever seen on film. And it is such a lovely, sweet movie about first love, about enduring love, about, you know, sliding doors of our lives and the choices we make. It's really, really, really good. So that's one thing. And then the other thing that has come up, I think it's on Netflix now, is a show that I first discovered in Ireland years ago on the BBC accidentally. Have you heard of this? It's called Naked Attraction.
No.
Okay. It is a game show.
Oh, no, I know what it is.
You know what it is.
I have read about it. Yes.
Okay.
Yes. It's crazy.
It's crazy. And you can watch it on Netflix. And it is literally a dating show where the first thing you see is the person that you're going to pick's genitals.
Unbelievable.
It is. You choose the first layer of choosing. The first round of choosing is just a choice on which genitals you're most attracted to. Then it goes up to torso. Then it goes up to face. Then it goes to voice. And that's how you fucking pick. And it is so weird because so many of these people have high success rates of relationships after this dating show. And I'm like, is that it? Should I just see
the key?
Is that the key? You should just see the penis first or the vulva? Like, is that it?
God.
Anyway, it's amazing. You can't watch too much of it because it's kind of like, it like makes you sick after a while. Just too much nudity.
Yeah.
But like the first couple times you watch it, like I was just surprised. I just turned on the BBC one night in Ireland and I happened to turn it on and I was high and I was like, what the fuck is this? Why are there just dicks? Anyway, I definitely think everybody, Naked Attraction, it's on Netflix. So highly recommend as a game show.
And we have such a good episode today. I think we really just need to get in it.
We're just going to get in it. All right. Our guest today is Alex Audere. Alex is a writer and actress who was born in New York City to Viva, a Warhol superstar, and Michelle Audere, an award-winning filmmaker who directed Chelsea Girls with Andy Warhol. Alex has been featured in HBO's High Maintenance and has acted in the films of Wim Wenders and Jodie Foster, among others. Her new book, Don't Call Me Home, is a pitch-perfect memoir of her unconventional childhood. Welcome, Alex. Hi.
Thanks so much for having me on. It's a real pleasure.
So we're so excited to have you on, and congratulations on your book, which is just stunning. This book lived inside of you for a long time. You wrote that you started it in college. What do you think made you feel ready to finally write it?
Thanks for asking. And I just want to say before we even start with that, that I just listened to you on your one of your last episodes. I think, Kim, you were talking about the dewy face, the mermaid thing.
Oh, yeah. Jen was talking about that. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes,
or the glazed donut.
And the glazed donut.
Yeah. And I actually never have worn makeup in my life until this book launch. I got skin makeup and I go for the glazed donut. Like, I didn't know that's what it was called, but yes. They were like, use this and this. And I'm like the most low maintenance. Like, I barely even shower. I'm just telling you, I'm not even like trying to exaggerate. So, but lately now I put on I always put moisturizer on in general before I go to bed, like oily. So now I do everything I said. I put this like fucking gel thing on first and then the, you know, lightly tinted, you know, base makeup. And I look like I just stuck my face in a bunch of dew and I love it, but I don't have it on right
now. It's the look. It's the old person look. That is it. That's what you want. That's 100% like 50s. Yes.
I didn't know that they had that technology now. And because normally when I've done movies and they put the base on, I look absolutely horrible.
Yes.
And it brings out all the wrinkles.
Yes. Yes. Wait, so what are you using? What's your foundation?
Well, it's okay. It's like, I know I totally like obfuscated your question, but it's RMS, that brand.
Oh, yeah.
That's a great brand. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then they get you, normally I'd be like, that's total bullshit. But she got me to buy. So it's in those big bottles you pull out and you squeeze, like a ridiculous packaging that's totally overdone. But it's like this clear stuff you put on before you put the base on, you know,
primer.
Yes, that's it. Primer. Yeah. And I will say the primer is amazing. And then sometimes I even put moisturizer on before the primer and I'm like, damn, bitch, that looks good. Like, the problem is that I hate the way I look without it.
Oh, well, that's becomes a problem. Yes.
Alex Otter, can I just say, I love you already. And we just started this podcast because we're always like, can we ask them about their beauty products when guests come on?
We're like, oh my God, they're only going to want to promote their projects. So we better ask questions.
I'm so sick of talking about my project at this
point. Of course you are. Oh my God.
It's like excruciating to hear you read that introduction. You know, I'm like, oh my God. I just hate myself, you know, but yeah, now I will answer.
Yeah, of course. Cause you're writing, you wrote a memoir and now you're having to talk about only you and the memoir. It's like, you get so sick of yourself.
And to go to your question, that was a good segue. I did really write a version of it literally. I can't do math when I was in my 20s and I'm 52 now, you know?
Wow. Mm-hmm.
So it's really makes me sick, but, and you might be the last podcast I'll do about it. So lucky you. So I did, you know, I wrote this version that was fiction way back when in college. And then, you know, and then a professor after, you know, for my senior thesis, you would call it at Bard College, a professor said, let's work on it more and I'll give it to my agent. So then her agent after college said, rejected it and said she wanted it to be nonfiction. So I would say this was in like, you know, the mid towards late 90s.
Yeah.
And then I put it away for many, many years. I had, let's say, my daughter in 2003. She's 20 now. So I think that's when she was about a year old, I started turning it into fiction.
Okay.
So that's 20 years ago. Oh, sorry, started turning
into nonfiction. Yeah. No, I got you. I'm following you.
Turned it from fiction to nonfiction. Another writer, an amazing writer, Joanne Beard, was helping me edit that. A lot of writers used to come to my yoga studio in Rhinebeck, mm-hmm. where I used to have a yoga studio near Bard College.
Okay.
It was like a real writer's hub. Mary Gateskill, Joanne Beard, like some of my favorite writers.
Yeah.
But I coerced Joanne to help me, and she was a big fan of the book. Then she helped me send it to many, many agents in this fiction form, all rejected, like really by a dozen agents, I would say. So then I put that away, you know, it's just like went on and on. Then tried again, a different version in New York, let's say when my daughter was like six, got an agent, but no publishers would take it. So then, you know, what changed when I was 49 or so, 50? I don't know. You know what changed? It's that like, the publishing world are fucking idiots, you know, because I had that profile in the New York Times about my Instagram account satiring, mm-hmm. you know, the
Stop.
Wellness industry. I'm not kidding. And so that's because I had that. I was someone important.
Get the fuck out of here.
Of course. That surprises me not at all. But what I want to hear is how would this book have been different if it had been published 10 years ago or 15 years ago?
Or 20. 30.
I want to say much better. Who knows? Just really different, you know? Obviously way more perspective. I mean, the crux of the story, I would say the narrator, you know, because I always think of myself as a character, even though it's nonfiction, is from a younger point of view. And a lot of that is quite similar, like Joanne Beard agreed, to the early drafts, the kind of chronological birth, because I start with my birth because, you know, I would watch my own birth on video because my dad was a video artist. So I do my birth as though it's, you know, I transcribe my birth video in a way that you really do start literally with, you know, my head coming out of the vagina.
Yes.
And so that story, obviously, you know, rewritten and slightly different voice and tone, but that's very similar. But the now sections from the point of view of me as a middle-aged woman in Philadelphia, I think really gave the book its final, you know, oomph. You know,
so and you as a mother too.
Yeah,
I thought that was really like, I loved seeing that because I don't have a Warhol superstar mother, but I have a narcissistic mother, and I saw so much of it. You know, that you cannot ever get to a reality with this person. You can't. But it was interesting as you had to accept your own fallibility as a mother. I think you were able to see your mother more clearly. It doesn't make her okay, but I wonder if that was part of it too. Was that interesting to you, thinking about her as a mother and thinking of yourself as a mother?
Yeah, that's really so true. And I do think that is the question of what it gave. You're right. And I didn't even think of that, is that I was a mother during writing this draft. And I think that gave it something that was missing in the past, that like, even though I joke that the publishing industry are idiots, that's also true. And I do think they were noting that there was something not quite cohesively coming out in the book, you know, I hadn't accessed something. Yeah. So I think the motherhood, it was a big deal. And people used to always say to me, oh, when you're a mother, you'll understand your mother more. And I wanted to be like, fuck you. You have no idea what I'm dealing with. And on some level that was true, you know, but I would say actually, as my daughter, you know, became a teenager, yeah, it wasn't necessarily that I had sympathy for my mother, because so different, you know, like the way my daughter's personality was so different than mine, because I was, you know, a parentified child, a pleaser and all that, you know, and that's not luckily what my daughter was. Yet I will say, on a more esoteric meta level, I definitely felt for my mother. And I always have, you know, we've maintained a closeness, although now no longer, we're a bit estranged now, but we had maintained a closeness for a long time. But yes, as you say, with a narcissistic parent, although my mother would go crazy to be called a narcissist.
Yes, of course. Right.
Narcissistic parent. First rule of the narcissistic parent is the narcissistic parent goes crazy when they're called a narcissistic parent.
How do you think that makes me feel?
Yes. Yeah. But I really wanted to get that across. You know, a lot of people are like, oh, you were neglected when you were a child, or, you know, abused and stuff. And it's really not that, or I don't feel it's that. The reader can decide whatever they want. That's fine with me. To me, I really wanted to show the relentlessness of living in a small space with a narcissistic person.
There is, I mean, even if I cannot relate to the living in the small space, there, I feel like there is something for every woman who has a complicated relationship with her mother, which is basically every woman with a mother.
Yeah, yeah.
Pretty much. I mean, there were moments, I think, when I, you know, my childhood was suburban and very different than yours, but I had a mother who was on her own 70s journey.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it. I do think that there's something, but there is a question.
No, I appreciate
you're gonna
saying
get
that,
it.
Kim, because I think that's that writer Joanne Beard, who I mentioned, I just happened to find her pages that she wrote to ask me. They were folded in something in my book when we did our In Conversation in the Rhinecliffe Library. And I'd never read how she had prepared. And it was so cool because she's honestly one of my favorite writers. And I just read it, and she said really similar to what you just said. You know, she said that she felt that one of the successes of the book was that while Viva is so idiosyncratic in the story, it's also relatable to anyone with a mother.
I mean, the part where you it's not giving anything away to say you fantasize a great deal in this book about physical harm, doing physical harm to your mother. You acknowledge that twice you actually have, like, come mm-hmm. at her.
Yep.
That, I mean, that is so visceral. I think, I mean, it just any woman can understand that feeling of that particular stripe of rage at your and at nobody but your mother.
Yes, yes. Although then it did translate to my husband, my current husband, who I'm still with and have been with for 30 years. But yes, that kind of, and I think when it's not resolved, which I suppose it's not for me, I got with my husband, you know, so young. So there's a sense of like detaching the umbilical cord from my mother and reattaching to Nick, my husband. And so there we have had to deal, I mean, and he has, you know, man rage problems as well. So that has been a thing in our marriage and, you know, where I will internally be like, now I want to hit him over the head with the frying pan, you know?
Yeah.
I haven't just yet.
Well, when there's no regulation taught in a house, when there's no self-regulation modeled for you from a parent, it's like, it's so hard then when you are, you know, poked and prodded as you go into the world and you just have no idea. And it takes such a long time to figure out that you have no idea.
Yeah.
Because you have no sense of normal, right?
Yeah, no, like, exactly. And then when you're poked, and then, you know, for whatever reason, Nick and I became super domestic really early on, you know, and I was not used to being poked and prodded, you know, by anyone other than Viva. So generally in the outer world, people think of me as this very like, I was going to say calm, but not that, you know, because I'm known as being a little, you know, exhibitionist and whatever, hyper and talkative, but not reactive in an angry or violent way, you know, and very tolerant. But yet I have this other inner world that's really the opposite, you know, but only certain people, like you said, Kim, only my mother or my husband, you know, when poked in a certain way can, you don't want to be around.
Yeah. I see you. I'm going to go off for the book from a second. Cause one thing that I really admire about you is a lot of times this show is for women in midlife. And a lot of times women in midlife feel like they are getting invisible and, you know, lost. And I see you as just fucking thriving. I just see you as just, you're just energy just coming out. I really feel you coming into something just as from the little I know of your career. Do you feel like that? Because you just seem amazing at 52.
Yeah, I wish you had seen a screenshot of me yesterday trying to decode my kid's new public school Chromebook applications. Like I was literally crying. Not kidding, like actually crying.
Yes, but personally, let's not talk about technology, but like personally, like you seem creatively to be, how do you feel at 52?
That's sweet to say. I mean, you know what? I'll not self-criticize and I'll say I do feel that way now. And I think there is something about, you know, late bloomers, like getting a little bit of a career boost in the literary world at this age has been really vindicating and good feeling, I'll admit. And I was really at my wit's end with the yoga career. And that's the yoga careers. I never wanted that. You know, that was something that I fell into for whatever reason we fall into things in life. And that became how I made a living, you know, and what I was known for. And so being able to kind of retire, because, you know, I always joke, like, you've never seen a retired yoga teacher because they can't retire. You know? You know, try to get monetary, you know, help and to finish writing the book and then be able to be seen as an author, you know, has been really wonderful. And yeah, I do feel like I was joking with a bunch of people at Yale the other day, a bunch of old Yale people, some fellows. I had to address the fellows that being in my 50s and now, you know, trying to write more, it's a real relief because you know, you don't have that much longer to live. So there's that much less you have to do. So like if I was like 25 and had published the memoir and I was like, oh fuck, I have like another 50 years, you know, to fucking write. Now I'm like, okay, you know, it takes like 10 years to write a book. I have like two more books, maybe one more.
Yeah. Jen and I call that bringing your B game. We are all in favor of.
Totally.
Yeah. I'm super in favor of it. And like, you know, I mean, I know that's not true for a lot of women of our age, but I feel so like into not having to think as much about my body and my looks. Like I'm into the wrinkles and the gray hair.
Right. Yeah. You know? Yeah.
Have you always been, or was that something you arrived at?
Well, it's hard to say, you know, considering, I guess I think I thought I had wrinkles before. So I think when I thought I had wrinkles, which I realized I didn't, I wasn't into it. But I always was very much against self-alteration in that way. Obviously been around a ton of people who do it. No judgment, right. Judgment.
Right. But, right.
But, I do find it almost a betrayal, you know, when someone I know is doing it, I feel like, cause people will say, oh, you're so beautiful and da, da, da. Like, let's say to me. And I'm like, yeah. Well, if you think I'm beautiful, then why are you doing that to you?
Right.
You know what I mean?
Oh, well, we're so much harder on ourselves than we are on other people though.
I know, yeah. But it makes me feel sad.
Let's take a quick break from some ads.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
And we're back. I wonder if you feel like you were able to get out from under her shadow by writing this. Was there a part of that?
I think publishing it and finishing it did feel like that. You know, there's some level because I'd been writing it for so long, it didn't have that like cathartic thing. Do you know what I mean? Like when I finished, it wasn't like, and the end, da-da.
Right, right.
But, well, we're in this strange place of this, you know, estrangement light, I call it. Mm-hmm. So it's a weird mixture of being like done with it and not caring, but also be worrying, oh, if I find out she dies tomorrow, then how do I feel? I'm not really sure, you know? It's a little bit of a strange space I'm in now, but I'm very good at compartmentalizing, so I often don't think about it. But recently she sent some emails. Have you heard about this alert we're getting on our phones tomorrow? It's like, for some reason, the iPhones are doing an alert. It's in the mainstream news, and it's like, oh, just turn the volume down, whatever. But so my mom just sent her, you know, conspiracy emails, which is like she wants us all to get out of the house and go walking in the woods with no technology whatsoever.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, and she didn't have a great response to this book. I mean, I was following it was amazing following you. You were taking screen grabs of her conversations on Facebook about the group. I mean, about the book and on a Facebook group about the book. And it was hilarious and amazing. Like she clearly, is that why you're estranged because of the book or is it,
I mean,
you don't have to say why, but
no, it's, I don't mind saying why. I think so. It started a bit before the book with COVID stuff, but not because I was upset that she didn't believe in COVID or whatever. I mean, I don't really care. Do you know what I mean? She's had so many, she's believes in chemtrails and doesn't think 9/11 happened. So it's not, that wasn't anything new to me, though. Right. I guess COVID really, you know, Facebook and COVID really radicalized her in that way. So mm-hmm. it was more relentless than usual.
Yeah.
And so that made it hard to, and then that coincided with her finding out about the book, but she hadn't read it yet. And then really deciding that the book had turned, you know, someone else in the family against her.
Okay.
And, but that person hadn't even read the book either. So it became very convoluted to the point where I needed a break, you know, like, and I was had to like do some blocking for a while. Then I unblocked and there was like a fine moment during the book launch where I was including her, like showing her some, FaceTiming her when I stayed in the Chelsea Hotel for two nights in this fancy mm-hmm. suite because it's all fancy now, you know? And I was like, look how crazy this is. We're two floors above our old apartment. It's the same view, but look at this insane stove. Like the room was so yeah. fancy. You know, just the price of the stove was probably like 3 years of our rent, you know?
Right.
She was laughing and enjoying it. But then, of course, she has these crazy fucking people in her ear. You know, she listens to everything the last person tells her. You know, so someone said that in the book, I said that she threw all our pets out the window in Topanga Canyon. And it was like an animal rights activist.
Oh, God.
Yeah. I mean, there is a scene of abandoning pets, but it has nothing to – it's not about like she's a bad person. It's just like showing the 70s – personality, you know, the 70s vibe.
That's how we treated pets.
Yeah, you don't fucking brush your pet's teeth. You throw. You
no, we got in so much trouble. We got in so much trouble on the show talking about stories about our pets, like growing up when we were young, and people like wrote like we had never listen again, unfollow,
stop.
And we were like, yeah,
because Jen told a story which is a horrible story, but also a kind of hilarious story about how when her dad ran the cat family cat over in the driveway. And he told his children, who were not that young when he told them this,
yes.
that the cat committed suicide.
That is so fucking funny. And that's so crazy. Well, we're probably going to get people mad right now, but we always have had pets, me and our family, my now family, not when I was a child, and we love them, but I'm not going to fucking brush my pet's teeth. Like if the pet gets sick and it's $6,000, sorry, am I going to not buy groceries or fix the perforated diaphragm of the cat? No.
That's also like a class thing. It gets into so many things, so many issues, but there is like a rolling, like if you grow up in chaos, like if you grew up in the chaos of the 70s in particular, like you just have a different perspective of the world than if you had like a very nice, stable life. Like
yes,
it's just,
yes.
You just don't care about things in the same way.
But this brings me to my other thing, which is that, you know, you did have this like really fascinating, crazy childhood, you know, and you had, you know, it was kind of glamorous and also kind of hardscrabble. But when was there a moment when you looked around and you were like, oh, we're not like other people? Like Cindy Sherman is my stepmother.
Well, you know, like when Cindy was my stepmother first, she wasn't Cindy Sherman, you know, she lived in like a worse apartment than we did. She lived in this crazy little apartment in the near the Fulton Street Fish Market that had the bathroom, and the shared bathroom was in the hallway, you know, like the toilet was in the hallway and the shower was in the kitchen. And
wow,
she wasn't anything fancy. So, you know, all of our, I have to say, no, the only, because all my downtown public school friends, you know, their parents were similar. They were all artists, you know, or my friend Zoe was a tap dance teacher in Soho, but huge loft in Soho. Like, you know, in those days you lived in big lofts in Soho as a single mother tap dancer, you know?
Mm-hmm. Right.
So the only time I thought that was, I somehow knew the Chelsea Hotel was thought of as cool. In that scene, you know, later people were like, right. Oh, that sounds awful and disgusting. But in that crowd, people thought it was, they were like, oh, you live like in high school. Some of my friends were like, oh, can we come over? You live in the Chelsea, you know?
Yeah.
And nobody really knew who my mom was. Do you know what I mean? Like nobody was like kids my age that weren't interested in the Warhol thing, but I did know my mom was something because adults would say, oh, you're Viva, you know, or something on the street once in a while.
Right.
And when we did movies, sometimes like the Wim Wenders movie, yeah, I knew that was different. But then again, you know, then I went to a high school briefly, not LaGuardia. I switched to PCS where, you know, it was like Martha Plimpton was there. You know, it wasn't like, I was actually the least successful in a way, you know, because right. I didn't like work much after that. So it didn't seem that wild and crazy. More dealing with the internal psyche was the thing that I secretly was like, felt maintaining all the time, you know, like dealing.
Talk
with,
more about that.
Of like the internal world of our apartment, you know, that I tried to describe in the book was more what I felt was, or what I'd be curious, like, is this, do other people have to deal with this? I always felt like I had this like albatross chain around me. Anytime I went out or was having fun, it was always like this beating black heart of guilt, you know, and nerves about what was going to be on the other side of the door. So in a weird way to me, that was a thing, not any of what might be considered glamorous or right. cool, you know.
Right.
One of the things that I feel in this book, and even you talking about New York in that time, is I feel a grief for New York, for yeah. a kind of New York.
Yeah.
And I think, Kim, you responded to that as well. Do you feel that grief, Alex? Like, do you?
Yeah.
I grieve because I grew up in Philly. I grew up going up to New York. Like, do you grieve the New York that doesn't
really
exist
do.
Anymore?
Yeah. Yeah, I really do. And I still, you know, want to believe it's there sometimes. And when I go back, and sometimes I think there are, you know, kids who, when I say kids, you know what I mean? Younger adults who are, have a great scene in New York. You know, I do think yeah. it's probably annoying for people who are in a cool scene in New York to hear me say that, because I'm sure there are pockets, but they're certainly hard to access, you know?
But
I definitely do. And I have to remind myself not to be too bitter, you know, because it's annoying. Like, even when I go now to the Chelsea, because sometimes I still get my hair cut there by an amazing guy.
Oh my God, Minna Carol. Gets her hair cut by that guy. That's yeah, yes, yeah. yes, 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 yes.
Gerald.
Yeah. Yes, Gerald. Yes, continue.
Hi, Gerald.
Yes.
Yeah, so you know, even now going in, I get annoyed, even in the Chelsea, which is so stupid. Who cares? But they truly, like, you know, in the fancy state it's in, I want to be like, so, you know, I just want to have like a free pass. Like, I want somehow a sticker where someone's like, okay, she can just walk in. This was her home, you know?
Yeah.
And like in the bar, yeah. there's a cocktail named after my
yes.
mom to be a superstar. You know, it's $30.
Oh my God.
And I made a joke to the bartender, like, so can I get this for free? I know I sound like an asshole, like some crazy ass bitch when I'm talking, you know, I can't help myself because the bartender literally, yeah, he doesn't give two shits and in fact is really annoyed. And I've said it now like three times. Like, and I'm sure he's like, please someone else help this woman. And I'm like, I guess I should get it free. And that's my mother. And I'm like, not kidding, you know, or, oh, I guess it's not free. Like when I get the bill and it yeah. just makes me really mad. And I want to do something fucked up. Like, you know, I really want to sick my mother on them and have her call them every day relentlessly and be like, you get my name off that fucking menu.
Well, it's funny because we all three are people who have some relationship to Philadelphia.
Yeah.
I my husband's from there and I go there when he has work there a lot. So I'll go with him.
And what does he do?
He's the School of Rock guy. Yeah. Sorry.
That's so cool. Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry. Kim, go ahead.
But like Philadelphia, you can walk around and it's like, here's that old hat store sign
yes,
that's been
still
there forever.
Here.
And
that's
here's
right.
this bar that's been there forever. Like, you know, there's construction happening and the city is changing, but there's a lot of shit that's been there for a long time.
Dirty and Franks has been there since I was 19 years old. Dirty Franks is still there. I went back last year. I was like, how the fuck is this still here? The Last Drop Cafe, the coffee shop I went to, still there. It's amazing. It's amazing. Anyway, continue with your point, Kim.
No, yes. that's my whole point. Like, yes. you know, when I go to Philadelphia, it's like, this is a city that you could walk around and feel your childhood in.
Yes, yes. Yeah. And I live with people now who did, you know, my husband grew up here and our good friend Abby grew up here. A lot of people who we're good friends with now all grew up here and are back here. And they all are always saying that, you know, that it looks all these similar things, you know? Yeah, I know Philly is, it's so, my God, it's so different than New York, you know? I mean, it's like, I try to like describe it to myself and the people, it's very hard. I mean, not like in cool, in bad ways and in wonderful ways, you know?
Yes.
Like even trying yeah. to describe Mount Airy, like my New York friends are like, oh, you live in the suburbs. And I'm like, well, it's,
no, it's right in the city.
Yeah. And I, but it's like, doesn't seem like that to them, of course, with these big schist houses. Oh, you know, I just got a bumper sticker that the Mount Airy neighbors made called I give a schist about Mount Airy. Isn't that incredible? And schist is written in with like schist rock letters.
That's so incredible. Like also, but Philly is, I mean, the thing is about Philly, you have to be able to be, you have to be able to have like a sort of confrontational nature to your, like you have to be able to handle people in your face. And I live in LA and nobody is ever in your face here. And right. It is the loneliest. It is such, this is worse culture shock for me because nobody ever, like nobody even acknowledges that you exist. It's just like it's politeness so all the time. Yes.
My husband loves LA and we lived there briefly and yeah. I felt that loneliness too, but I still would live there. I mean, it's so beautiful, but and so Philly, you know, obviously it's called the city of brotherly love. I find New York brotherly love, but Nick, yes. My husband, the Philadelphian, thinks New York's are fucking cunts, yes. You know? And so I find Philadelphians to be really rude and, or it's the Quaker personality type,
you yes.
know, which is lovely. I love Quakers, but not much sense of humor, you know?
I love that's another great scene, the Quaker meeting.
Yeah, that was my little revenge book. Chapter, you know. I didn't say the name of the school, but a lot of people will know who it is.
I know what it is, yes.
I think I know what it was because I think it's where my yes. I think it's where my husband's kids went.
His kids went to GFS. Everybody knows now I'm talking about GFS. My husband went there too. So your husband went there?
No, his kids went there.
Oh, his kids, right. Got it.
I have a question. I really do want to ask about this because you've said that this book is a love story. And that seems obvious, but it like, how did you pull that off?
I'm glad I did. I mean, I said that to prepare so my mother would be, my mother, oh, it's a love
story. Oh, I'm all ears now. Yes.
it seemed to work. I mean, I was nervous about, well, one, I was excited to get any review. You know what I mean? Like, I was like, oh, if somebody reviews this, lucky me, whether it's fucked up review or nice review. I was really happy when reviews were coming in, and one, they were positive, but two, a lot of reviewers did say that, you know, that it had this love in it and this love story, and or maybe they only read the first part.
Yeah, nobody reads past 70.
Did you read the whole book?
Yes.
No, not you.
We did. No, but she's saying, no, but people, that's the truth. People only read the first 50 pages and it's such bullshit. You're like, in these interviews, you're like, you don't know what happened.
No, exactly. Oh, I've done a podcast where the person read not the book at all.
Just read reviews of it?
Barely that. No, like it was really insane. Not even a review. Literally had no idea. I can't even get into it. But anyway,
yeah.
No, I know you two thoroughly read the book. No, but I just was joking about, yeah, the reviewers like that. But no, because I do think, I don't know how I pulled it off. I mean, I hope I did. I think because it is, because I do feel that love, you know, and even now I do feel that love. I think you can really, I think one can really, you know, hold both in their hearts and brains, you know, both, even if your one's estranged from a sibling or a parent or even a friend, I do think you can still love them, you know, but it just, the in real time dynamic doesn't work. You know, I feel like I've had that experience a lot with friends and family.
Yeah. And especially with longtime friends and family, like sometimes it's, you know, the relationships are a lot more expansive than we give them credit for. Like sometimes you're just supposed to be in your own corners and then you come back and you like, it's not really realistic to think that the people in your life are going to be compatible with you over your entire life as you continue to change and grow. It's like as if you're supposed to remain static and the relationship would remain static, which would be a terrible life.
Really terrible. Yeah. And I think, and when you look back as you get older, you know, I'm sure like an 80-year-old listening to us would be laughing hysterically because we
totally
so young to an 80-year-old. I always think that, you know, but yet we can say now that we're this age, we do have some perspective. And I do think that, you see these different phases of relationship, you know, and sometimes it's very painful. Like I have friends that I love so much and there's been no falling out. It's just our lives took different directions.
Yeah.
We're not even that far from each other, but somehow the rhythm doesn't happen. And I just miss and love them so much, you know, and then you try to get back in touch, but it's like hard because it's like your daily life patterns don't work like that. But like, I know with my mother, for example, if I try to have a phone conversation with her, it's like, you know, if we if anything other than just niceties are said, which is, it's possible to do. And I've had many years where we do that, you know, I'm just like still so sorry to use the word, but triggered, you know, and like, yeah. I can like really be like thrown off for hours where I get that, you know, I want to just like, you know,
or days, honestly, depending on how long you talk to them.
Yeah.
Well, it's hard too, because when parents reach a certain age, you know, they're not going to change. Like for a long time, there is hopefulness that maybe they will see your perspective. Maybe they will change some of their behavior after a certain age. And I don't know what it is like that. That just doesn't happen. And so your relationship with them becomes less genuine.
Yes.
Because you're more willing to do things like apologize when maybe you don't really mean it, just to keep the peace and things like that. But the relationship's urgency.
Yes, it's so true. That's a really good point. The urgency has changed. And then that brings, once we get to this age or to my age in your 50s and your parents, a lot of us, our parents are now in our 80s, you know, death could be at any moment around the corner. And and so it's strange, that lack of urgency, because sometimes in this weird way, it sounds so dark to say this, but I don't feel that way. I'm just like, what would be the difference if she's dead today? You know, you're not talking to the person, you know,
yet.
There is this, you know, energetically, it does feel like, okay, yes, that's different. The human body isn't in the world anymore. And there does seem like there should be something resolved before that. But like, it might, but you can't resolve, as you say, Kim, if there's no changing. So it's a very weird, like, you know, I hate to use this overused word, but this liminal state to be in, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Where are you on forgiveness? Like, we've had people come on with difficult relationships with their families and, you know, all kinds of trauma. Yeah. And we've talked about forgiveness a lot. Where are you now with forgiveness? Because, you know, it's different than acceptance and, you know.
Yeah. Well, I always have this joke about it. I might even have it in the book. I actually strangely can't remember. I think I do. But, you know, I only want to do the forgiveness if the person's literally taking their last breath, you know.
That's
because I'm like, which is sometimes why I look forward to death, because it's like, if you forgive with the whatever personality disorder type we want to lay on people we're talking about, narcissistic personality, it's like they will never forget that, you know? So it's like, you forgave me. And so da da do dee do, you know? And it's like, do you want to forgive and then fucking be like chained to the forgiveness basement in their heart for that? No.
Like, I feel like this is a movie.
I mean, it is a movie. I mean, I'm sure you're thinking of, you have cinema all around you. I'm sure you're thinking this is a movie.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the powers that be go right into that. So there's some, you know, yabbering in the works, but nothing announceable or nothing solid, but I'm into it, you know. I need a job, basically.
Yeah.
so I know you have a new job, Kim, or at least more recently.
Jen does. Yeah.
I just finished writing a book, and you know, it's funny because everybody sees the cover of the book and they're like, oh, the book, it's so great, but you can't live on books. Like, it's not, like I had to get a job.
So wait, for some reason I thought it was Kim who had the new job. It's you, Jen. Okay. Yeah. Well, congrats. Yes. Yeah. Thanks. I really need a job. So anybody, I'm doing my old gig this weekend, teaching a yoga retreat, or the podcast probably will come out after that. But I only do that if I just love the scene, you know, the yoga retreat scene. That I still have a very good friend, and I still do this retreat with her. But so I mean, I hope that partially me wanting to do the movie version would just be, it would be, you know, if I was a co-writer and producer, I'd have a job, you know?
That's right.
I just want to backtrack because I was very intrigued when you said you're like over yoga. Mm-hmm.
Yes. I want to talk about the whole wellness thing. You hate wellness. I want to talk about it because I do too.
I mean, even forgiveness is part of that. You know, I want to say that I do believe in forgiveness, for the record, but easier said than done. I don't know. I just, at this point, I could come back full circle. I'm like, I probably should do some yoga. It does feel good, you know? Breathing feels good. But I think having been in that world since I was in my early 20s, I mean, I really started yoga when I was in 89. I was 18.
So were you in New York? Were you in like the whole Jivamukti? Yes.
The old, original Jivamukti on 2nd Avenue, 9th and 10th. And I started teaching there.
Yeah.
Oh, you know? Wow. Okay. Yeah, it's a lot.
At that original space.
That was such a crazy cult.
Yes, so wild. It was. Yeah. Sharon was like my yoga mother. So I've really not just, you know, people say, oh, I've, you know, seen it all, but I have really been there since the, if we call the beginning in New York of yoga 1989. I mean, obviously yoga started in other centuries, but
right, but like the Western co-opting of yoga as we which know it. Yes, exactly. Yeah, as a, like a hot thing that like Time Out New York was covering. Yeah.
Exactly. And I just have little patience for a lot of the language, the you know, it got commodified in this way, and I would say it's like the height of neoliberalism. And maybe it's even coming through because on some level, you know, I was one of the people on Instagram to kind of point this out. Of course, this all happened. It's a big wave of stuff. So there's many, many people who are pointing it out before me. But for whatever reason, I was part of this wave of, you know, for example, calling out the idea of manifestation, which I find to be extremely insensitive to systemic racism. So to talk about money as being fluid and energy, and I would start to see these people, even my own like compatriots who I felt aligned with, were suddenly now teaching and saying these things that, you know, if you believe it enough, if you don't have scarcity mentality, I bristle at that.
Yeah.
And find it extremely offensive.
Yeah.
That's completely disregards socioeconomic class structures and economic injustice, you know? So to me, I find the yoga world turned a blind eye, and it really does have to do a lot with some of the intrinsic nature of yoga, which, you know, is based on karma and those karmic laws, which, you know, sorry to say, we'll probably get in trouble and somebody on this, but, you know, it's based on keeping people down. You know, it's like really sticking true to class, which is an issue in India, you know?
Right.
And then that got funneled into America, you know, and yes, it's majorly problematic.
Well, and I imagine it's like, it's part of the whole like sort of wellness industrial complex. It's the whole goopification of everything. It's like all of these modalities. And I was the chill out editor at Time Out New York for a minute, right? So I started seeing all of this happening. And what wound up happening was that all of these like really nurturing modalities started to be co-opted only by rich people. And it's continuing on, you know,
I grew up
hippie co-ops, whatever, like, and it was like, this stuff was accessible to everyone, you know, and now it's like, who can afford a $250 X, you know, which didn't used to be that way.
Exactly. Yeah. It was really wild to see that. And so once I started kind of talking about it and making those silly videos, but which were in my, you know, they were tackling important subjects, but, you know, done goofily. So I figured, well, someone either just laugh,
right,
which is fine, or they'll get, I'm talking about something else here as well.
Right.
You know?
right.
You know, like when I was pretending that I was interviewing Black men in jail and giving them like manifestation meditations to do.
Oh, Jesus Christ. okay.
I think it went over a lot of people's heads, you know?
Yeah.
But anyway, you know, then now I don't even bother with it because I think it is more widely understood that it's an issue, you know?
Yeah.
Right.
And call, you know, cancel culture. I mean, then, you know, tons of yoga teachers were canceled. I think cancel and call out culture was great in the yoga world. You know, I might have issues with it in other ways, but I was all for it in the yoga world.
Yeah.
You know, not to mention all the sexual abuse shit. I mean, you know, Bikram was literally, you can't.
Well, when they also, there's something about the deification of these teachers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, that just gets so potentially toxic. I go out to Sag Harbor. My family has a house there, and there's a studio there that people are very cult-like about.
Oh, yeah. I think I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah, you definitely do.
I've been there. Yeah.
No. And like, you know, I remember yoga, male yoga teachers, like balls hanging out. Like I remember this is not. Yeah. It's like intentionally, like they wanted everybody to see it. Like, you know, if that's happening, you can feel the wind. Like, totally. I feel like it's really like cult. Like it did. There was like a guru thing in the 90s, 2000s around yoga that was like, and then it just continued to get worse.
I wanted a guru, you know, I mean, there was a woman that I followed who's still an amazing woman, but I was into it, or a male. I would have taken whoever. I was definitely desperate seeker, you know, for that kind of thing. Right. But then when I would get closer, there was something that kind of, I don't know, you know, like something that stopped me from going full force. But I was pretty deep in, like I would do, you know, kirtan weekends and chanting. I still, you know, it's still an and for me. Like I could still totally get down with some really good bhajan, you know, and chanting and be like, oh, like, you know, with my eyes closed.
Yeah.
Like really healing for sure. Mm-hmm. You know, like Krishna Das, this guy, who's a famous, he's kind of like the, you know, like the Bob Dylan of yoga chanting. He's cool. He never got called out for doing anything weird, you know. And I still love him. I mean, I don't hang out. I don't go do retreats anymore. Now they're too huge, you know? And I would be really annoyed. Like to imagine, I've led so many retreats, you know, but to imagine being a student on a retreat is truly horrifying to me.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, especially the way everything is now. And also now it's all wrapped up in like diet culture and like, you know, starving yourself. Yes.
I have no patience whatsoever for the food stuff. I cannot. I think so many people have that. What's it called? Orthorexia.
Orthorexia.
Huge, big time, man. And I've always said that way back when people would fast, I'd be like, you know, the only time I fast is between breakfast and lunch, you know?
Yes.
I've never fasted.
Fasting was always starving. I don't care if there was lemon juice and maple syrup involved and like a sprinkle of cayenne.
Remember
like,
when everyone had them? Do they still do the lemon juice and maple syrup?
I don't know, but I remember it. It was like, I remember everywhere. My parents had like a pamphlet of it. It was everywhere.
I would fucking break my toe kicking over the lemon juice and cayenne pepper bottles while teaching, because sometimes I close my eyes while I'm walking around. So have no thing. I mean, it's bad with me because I get to the point where I literally poo-poo everything. So my friends will be like, you should take, you know, this. And I'm like, ah, fuck that. That doesn't do shit, you know? And so I'm really bad about it. You know, I make fun of every tiny little thing someone might do to improve their health, which, you know, I'll probably like die super early and they'll be like, yep, told her to take some vitamin B.
Well, I hope you don't die before you write more books, because really what came out of this book is you are an incredible writer. Like you are really an incredible writer. The pacing of this book is immaculate. Oh, it is. I read it and I listened to it because I loved it so much that I wanted that dual experience. You are such a good writer. I hope you write many books.
Don't make me cry.
No, somebody described the book as delightfully disturbing, which I thought was like such an, which was true, and such an incredible trick to pull off.
That's so sweet. I'm truly and deeply flattered. That means so much to me that you thought the pacing was good. Yeah, I vaguely remember that line too. And I was so moved by the review. Some of the reviews, like in papers I'd never read, like Washington Post, I thought were like, I was just really like in awe and amazed that people got so much of it. And I'm glad. I mean, I will say that my editor was Meg at Viking. She really helped with the pacing, because I'm really an over teller. You know, I write way too much.
Yeah.
So she would be like, I want three of these five stories, you know?
Right.
Yeah. Well, that comes from like being a storyteller and also having to pull focus from a narcissistic parent too, because you're just like, anything, I'll do anything. I'll perform. Yeah. Here I go.
Yeah.
You know, exactly. Like I'm a monkey.
Yeah. So without Meg, you know, it probably would have been like as long as, you know, Karl Ove Knausgård, you know.
Oh, nice one. Nice pronunciation.
I know.
Okay. So here's the question we always ask at the end. What do you still want to do, Alex?
I really want to travel. I mean, more like broader question, but no, I have another book, you know, in me that I won't talk about just because it's so boring to hear somebody's book in progress. So I need to, I have like part of it written. I've got some NDA issues to deal with that book. So I can't say, Yeah, but really what I want to do is, like, you know, be at my desk. I have a new room of my own. Well, sort of open to the whole house. It doesn't have a wall, but I have a space of my own. You know, it's like in Philly, you get these huge, huge houses, and then somehow you still don't have a room of your own. And I just love being at my desk and doing my morning pages while the kid is at school. And the kids are at school. Now I've got the one in college, so that's wonderful. Sorry, Louie, you know I love you, but I'm happy you don't live here anymore. And you know, maybe get a yoga class in here and there.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, that's it. Simple. Not big ambitions, you know? Publish another book, travel, breathe sometimes in a class.
Yeah.
Manageable steps is important.
Thank you for coming on. We really love your book. So, and everybody should go buy it.
Oh, and a dewy face.
Oh, yes. And a dewy face, obviously.
A dewy face. I so wish I could show you my mermaid face. I didn't put it on.
Well, I mean, next time in the next book.
This was amazing. You're a delight, Alex.
Yes.
Love you, ladies. Thank you so much for having me. I truly enjoyed it. I'm not just saying that.
Thanks for listening to Everything is Fine. We're your hosts. I'm Jen Romolini.
And I'm Kim France.
If you like the show, please rate and review it across the platforms, especially Apple Podcasts. It really helps people find the show. If you want to support the production of the show, we're on Patreon at patreon.com/everythingisfine. We blog there. We do special episodes there. We do all kinds of things there. We answer questions there. If you want to follow us on social media, we are on Facebook with a robust and private Facebook group. We are on Instagram at EAF Podcast. You can find Kim on her Substack, Girls of a Certain Age, kimfrance.substack.com. You can find me at Jen Romolini's Vanity on Instagram. It's in the show notes, both of these. And I want to thank Natalie Rivera once again, who mixes and edits the show. You are the best, and we'll be back next week.
The biggest names in tennis are coming to Paris for the most anticipated Roland Garros in years. Tennis Channel Plus is your place to watch. Stream every court from your phone or smart TV live in HD. Experience 3 weeks of unparalleled tournament access as the world's top players in tennis face off against each other. Will the veteran champions continue their dominance, or will a fresh face emerge to challenge their legacy on the clay courts? Daily live coverage of this epic showdown begins Monday, May 20th. Don't miss a matchup. Stream it now with Tennis Channel Plus to be there when it happens.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.